House Finance come to order. It's a little bit after 1:30, 1:46, but it still is April 4th, 2012. We have members present, Representative Jewell, Representative Guttenberg, Representative T. Wilson, Vice Chair Fairclough, Stoltz, Co-Chair Thomas, Representative Dugan, Representative Edgman, Representative Costello, and rounded out with Representative Newman. We have a quorum to do business. We adjourned our morning meeting with leaving House Bill 190, have some work done with the department and our capable vice chair. Why don't we just have Representative Feige and Ms. Bitney join us at the table so we're ready to go.
Just a new CS thing.
We have a, yep.
Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for the sponsor substitute for House Bill number 190, Finance 27-LS0564-L before the committee.
I'll object. Let the vice come on up, Joe. Mr. Michelle.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Joe Michelle, House Finance staff. The CS before the committee, version L, reflects the changes that the members had spoke about in the morning meeting this morning. You can see these changes. Well, you cannot see these changes because they are no longer in the bill. But on
visualize these changes. They had been there and now aren't there. Won't you please describe the language omitted?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Through the chair, in the original version, Section 2, subparagraph F, number 3, there was issue with giving examples in statute in regards to certain parameters. So in the version in front of the members, the phrase, such as the financial circumstances of the individual or the ability of the individual to find employment in the state, has been removed. The second change was Section 2, the very last number. It was number 6. It is no longer in the version before the committee. And that stated, and it's been struck, whether the individual made a career choice or chose a career path that does not allow the individual to reside in or return to the state. And that was removed from the CS in front of the committee.
Ms. Bitney, do you object to those potentially vague, ambiguous, or subjective portions of law being removed?
For the record, when it is.
No, those are my characterizations. Please characterize them as you wish. I would not want to lead our witness.
Thank you. Chairman, no, we don't have any issues at all with the changes.
Do you have even something stronger than that? Maybe some potential empathy or support?
What we're going to do here is we're going
to... The fence is an uncomfortable place to sit.
Sorry. I'm actually not on the fence. We intend to create regulations to really clearly, show how we're going to apply these statutes. And by not giving specific examples in the statute doesn't create any problems for us at all.
Does it make it easier?
It does make it easier, as a matter of fact. Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll remove my objection, and we extracted almost a position on it. And not extracted a fiscal note position, but a position of the department. I've removed my objection. Is there any objection to the previously moved CS? So it is before us again as a new updated committee substitute. Madam Vice Chair, without haste.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move from committee the CS for sponsor substitute House Bill number 190, Finance 27-LS0564-L, with attached fiscal notes and individual committee recommendations.
And without objection, that bill is moved. I would like to thank, it's been certainly a pleasure to have you here and help us through this process. And I also want to thank you for helping me figure out pick, click, and give this year. And you get a little, it's easy, but I think it's easy to get a little enthusiastic. You want to make sure you have a little of the dividend check left. But thank you for taking the time on a Saturday to show me how to do that without any prompting. I think out of almost sympathy. So we'll take a very brief of these. Back to order. After that brief at ease, after dispensing with House Bill 190, we have before us House Bill 365. Madam Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for House Bill number 365, Resource 27-LS1439-M before the committee.
Is there any objection to having the resources version?
Yes. I would like the changes from the original version to the resources version explained.
Okay. Tell us about your fine work in the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The main difference was that the term aquatic invasive species was changed to marine aquatic invasive species, and the purpose for that was that the testimony by the department was that there was a lot of plant material as well as some species that were fairly endemic throughout Alaska, pike being one, Alodia being a plant species, and if they were responding to those, it would have a huge, very large fiscal note. We had the biggest concern was being that coming in from in mariculture or coming along the coast was a large concern, huge economic impact, and so we drew back from all waters of the state where the Department of Fish and Game said it would have to draw a different plan up for every lake and water system to the marine environment.
And I remember when Representative Johnson introduced the invasive plant, there was an effort to be very inclusive of the fisheries industries and streams and rivers, and that's kind of strikes me as why would there be an exclusion when the agriculture community stepped forward? Is that maybe where you're leading, Representative Bettenberg?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. With no choreography, I guess we're finding ourselves in the same. Representative Bettenberg, did you have?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at an email that Linda Hay received, and she's the, who she works for right now. I think it's Representative Feige, talking about Alodia, and it's currently in Fairbanks, Anchorage, and the Cordova area, and what it's doing, blocking spawning habitat, degrading salmon habitat, and its effect on Sand Lake and use of floatplanes and other things. Trying to figure out why we have a problem. There's, we argue one size doesn't fit all here, but often it goes both ways. But invasive species is a statewide issue, and to say salt water is more important than fresh water or vice versa is a concern for me.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And there was no priority given that way. It was just that within the response we got from the departments was we wanted to make sure that we were providing an emergency basis for them to respond to a new invasive species. And, as long as we keep that so that we're talking about a limited geographic area and a new invasion, that's up to the committee. The problem would become if you talk about the letter that is being referenced by Representative Guttenberg, is that if you're talking about Alodia and you're talking about all these different lakes and all then you need an invasive species plan for an endemic species and how to handle that, or pike that are endemic throughout many of the areas of the state. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that Fish and Game and the other agencies have a way to respond very quickly in an emergency situation to a new invasion, such as occurred down at Whiting Harbor. Now, it could have been in a aquatic environment as well. And so as long as we make sure that we're talking about a rapid response for a new invasion in a limited geographic area where we can contain that and try and eliminate it in a very rapid response, then that was the purpose of the bill.
Okay. Did you follow up anything on that?
Well, I think my point's well made by Representative Seaton. The ability to rapid response, not everything comes up the coast into fresh water. Things just appear from pet shops that things get loose on, things that are brought in. It's not just a marine aquatic, it's just aquatic everywhere. And I, you know, even in my community, there's been a rapid response, calling an urgent call for help to come out and bring out your waders and walk through the sloughs because we got to get rid of this right now. And we don't know if that's going to be, that might be coming off of a freshwater to a marine water, which would be even more important to get before it hits a marine water. So I'll remove my objection and we can work on the resources bill, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Without objection, the resources bill before us, we have Representative Casella from Sand Lake.
Through the chair.
I'm sorry.
I think invasive species has a different meaning in your comment.
Touché.
Through the chair, this interim I met with members in my community who live around Sand Lake, and so my concern is similar to the previous comments about why we would identify just marine as the priority, because, and I was hoping you could share more of the conversation that you had in the Resources Committee.
Through the chair, Representative Costello, part of the big problem was that fishing game, in responding to creating a plan, decided if it's going to be aquatic, that means that they need to write a plan and look at all of the different lakes and all of the different streams throughout Alaska. And it was such a broad sweep that the fiscal note was going to be so large that, you know, the possibility of getting something like that through was pretty small. And we had a very definitive infestation of BVEX, which came out of Sitka, which could dramatically impact an area. It was a localized population instead of something that is down in the stream in many different lakes. So that's what this was about. I mean, I am fully in support of responding to and creating plans for handling invasive species throughout Alaska. And I do not object to broadening it to aquatics as long as we look at this in the position of not trying to do a plan for every single stream and lake as Fish and Game was trying to do, but look at an emergency situation in a limited geographic area where we can actually respond to it and take care of it. If we're looking at the contamination, shall we say, of a entire river system, there's no way that we're going to be in an emergency situation to devote enough time and resources to do that in a month or two. And that's what we are trying to do, is get this from a two-year proposition, which we've had DVEX in Whiting Harbor, and the question is, could it eliminate the Sitka Sound herring fishery, could it eliminate and spread all across to the mariculture industry in the entire southeast if that's not controlled? And it's been 2 years. And so we've got these long-term problems. And I have no problems as long as we are looking at a new infestation of something that isn't regional and all down the lake and water system, because that takes a longer-term endemic plan to handle that rather than an emergency reaction. But if we would have zebra mussels all of a sudden in Sand Lake, I would be the first person to say, you know, we need to respond rapidly to that before it goes anywhere else. So I hope that that balance is where we're trying to get to, but not so broad that we become the invasive species council and a 10-year plan.
Through the chair, I guess my comment is, I mean, just in general, but I think that, you know, in my district, we are dealing with safety issues related to this problem in the lake, and one of the concerns I have is that there are many ways to go about solving a problem that we have, whether it's, you know, in one district or region or statewide. So I just want to put out there for the record that my approach to this issue, which I became aware of, you know, this last year, was to submit a capital budget request to deal with a plan similar to what this legislation is trying to do. For those people who have been following this issue, we know it's quite severe and has ramifications that we may not even be aware of, and some communities are feeling that now, and some will be feeling that in the near future. So my comment has to do with whether or not, as a legislature, we want to address this as a policy in terms of how we deal with this, because we're now seeing legislative solutions on one hand, capital budget requests on the other, and it seems that if we want to arm the department with the tools that they need, that we probably should have that conversation in terms of how we want to approach this serious problem. Thank you.
Representative Newman and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Seaton, in my, as you state, the confined region of the state, the Susitna River Valley, we have a huge problem with an invasive species called northern pike that have devastated tributaries, Alexander Creek, which used to be a major tributary, that would spawn off thousands of different salmons, not just teen salmon, but the cohos and others. It just pretty much devastated it. Those all go into the Cook Inlet fisheries, and whether you're a sport fisherman, commercial fisherman, they have a tremendous, tremendous effect on our economy, probably just as serious as Divex could have, if not more. Where in this bill would we allow the department to act to respond to invasive species such as pike, which is identified by the department as an invasive species? It's not natural to that area, and it has devastating effects. I believe this year, I don't know, the department's here probably could correct me on it, 6 of 22 streams or tributaries where fisheries are monitored are below escapement levels, what they want, primarily a large part due to the pipe. Where in this bill or where in this bill can we talk about how those invasive species, which have devastated our fisheries, just as much as Divex is, where can we look at that in this bill and address it?
Through the chair, Representative Newman. The purpose of this bill is to give the tools to the department to do an emergency eradication in a limited geographic area. If we talk about doing an emergency eradication of pike in the entire Susitna drainage, I don't think that the people in the Susitna Valley would go for that, because you're talking about rotenone probably, but that's not only going to take pike, that's going to take salmon, that's going to take steelhead, that's going to take all those other things. So an endemic infection or an endemic infestation, it requires different tools. We have the tools that are being used right now under the invasive species plan are there for long-range planning, for going back in and doing those things. The purpose of this bill is so if we get a new invasive species in a very limited geographic area, we want to give the tools to the department to handle that. And if the committee decides they want to do that in a limited geographic area, a new invasive species, and give them the tools in the freshwater environment as well, I don't have a problem with that. The problem that we had was when they were identifying it, pike was brought up, and pike invasion on the Kenai Peninsula, you know, my area as well as the Susitna, is so broad and widespread that it's not handling it on an emergency basis where you go in and say, well, we've got one bay out of the whole coastline and we're going to kill off that bay. That's not something you would want to probably do on the Susitna River. So there are different ways in which you're going to have to handle an endemic infestation versus a emergency reaction to a new invasion in a limited geographic area. And so I am definitely not saying that saltwater species are more important than freshwater species. But we do have to realize that if you have an endemic infestation, you're going to have to handle that in a much different way than if you have a new invasion in a very limited geographic area and you're willing to say, you know, this bay will repopulate itself ecologically if we just go ahead and kill everything off in there. Part of this bill is to tell Fish and Game that, okay, there are some sea urchins in there and there are sea urchin divers, but you're not going to be able to say, we can't do anything because we have to balance that versus management tool for sea urchins. You're going to say, okay, we're going to allow the department to sacrifice management of sea urchins and sea cucumbers and some of the other things that are in that limited geographic area to make sure that we can control the spread or eliminate or eradicate this new invasive species. So there are two different questions. There's no one that I know of that thinks that invasive species, whether they're freshwater or marine, are good. But how do we handle a limited area versus a endemic invasion? And there are two different responses that we generally have.
Well, Mr. Chair. Representative Seaton, this is what we're doing is we're creating plans to be able to do with that. So if you say there's not a plan, we're creating, this is what this does is directs the department to create plans to do that. Now, if you look at Alexander Creek, and I'll just focus on that one and all those others, they go in and they specifically can target the northern pike because they do it in the early spring, just when ice is off. There isn't any salmon species in the tributaries that are large enough to be caught in the nets anyhow. There's some fry that will be going out, but there's no larger salmon fry that will be caught in the nets. They target the slough areas where they're in their spawning, so it does exactly what your bill says to. It's in small, isolated areas. They can go after some of these invasive species in marine aquatic areas. Is coming up with a long-term plan that will eradicate these to help save some of these fisheries, which is very important to our economy. So, but there is ways to do that. It's a matter of coming up and working it into a bill like this where we can do more than just deal with DVEX, where we do have areas that are under extreme stress because of invasive species that they can go do through that with the plan, and that's what I'd like to see done in this, Mr. Chair.
Hey, Mr. Chairman, if I just might respond very quickly. I totally agree with you, and like you said, there's a long-term plan that deals with when the juveniles are available, when it's coming out of ice situations, those kind of things, to target over a long period of time to go through a system and get it. What we're trying to do here is give the emergency authority to go in and just eliminate everything in that lake if it shows up. We had a problem with the identification by Fish and Game that they were going to have to do these emergency plans all over the state, and so we concentrated on the marine coastal environment. This is not just targeted at DVEX, which is, you know, sea vomit, which can just cover everything and spread around. So what we're trying to do is when you have, it may already be too late for DVEX. What we're trying to do is in the future, if green crabs are identified in here because we know that they're coming up the coast. If they're identified in Alaska, we would be able to go in and target that small geographic area in a bay and get rid of the population there before it could spread to the rest of areas. If there is, if you want to have that same solution in aquatic areas for limited geographic areas, that's not a problem. That's the way we originally wrote the bill. But the interpretation was that it was going to be an endemic population.
Mr. Chair, I would just like to explore the opportunity to look at that issue with the department.
Well, if I can just jump in, I read F as it could do that, Section F. There's section paragraph F on second page, last column.
That's kind of why I asked the sponsor of the bill. Is there a place in here already, or could be added into here? I feel that we already have that, but I wanted to hear what the sponsor had to say about it, and if not, maybe further clarification from the department. Maybe if there's a finance version that comes out there, we could further clarify that and look at it in fiscal note, which does not address it currently.
Well, I read F as covering it. Maybe I'm wrong, but because it's marine. I was looking for seawater, but it doesn't say it says marine.
Marine is water, freshwater, and marine,
it says any organism introduced into a marine ecosystem, which is not native. Looks like to me it would cover any stream or any water.
I agree.
Mr. Chairman, just for clarification, in the original bill that we had, F on the original bill says an aquatic invasive species. And so generally marine refers to saltwater invasive species. So in the current bill that you have before you, it's a marine and it's limited to saltwater. If you wanted to go back and refer to both freshwater and marine species, then you would go back and take the F from the A version, and that would cover what you're wanting to do.
I think that's what I'm hearing anyway. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and that's kind of where I'm going. And I appreciate you wanting to look at the fiscal note and trying to get it down. But my question really is that, you know, in this email, it talks about billions of dollars of damage each year by these species. And so I'm kind of curious, did anybody look at if we don't do anything in some of these other areas in which we might be able to eradicate it within 3 years because it's still in a small area versus if it gets into two or three more? Did Fish and Game do anything like that so that we know if we wait how many more lakes, you know, in the Anchorage or the Fairbanks area could have to be fought versus if we take care of the small area now?
And through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's a tool we're trying to give them in here. Right now they have a invasive species council that does long-range plans, but they don't have the tool to say, whoops, we've got something that has just come here to Alaska for the first time, and we need to get rid of it. This provides them the tools to disregard the other economic effects and the other management effects and say the most important thing, the priority number one, is to kill off that species. Whether you kill off some other species in that localized area or not, you don't get into the environmental impact statement kind of idea where you're going through and categorizing everything. You know, Michigan had an infestation, and 2 months later they had totally killed off a lake. We don't have the tools to respond that quickly in Alaska. This is to provide the tool to do that, whether the committee chooses to go back to aquatic, which would be both marine and freshwater species, or whether, as the resources version has it, the marine species, that's a question for the committee. And, I'm happy either way. What I want to do is I want to see emergency response capability so that we don't sit around and wait for either wherever a invasion occurs.
And just a follow-up, just to make sure I'm understanding. So if right now we would just be doing it, an emergency plan for saltwater, if we took that out, we would be looking for at least two plans versus just one. Is that what you're looking for, and that's what makes the fiscal note lower?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, that's correct. The department said that it needed all of these. The lake systems are so different because when you talk about an aquatic system that's on the North Slope or Nome or Kotzebue or that the plans to develop on each one of those things was so broad that it was going to take the 10 years to develop the plans to cover everything versus the marine ecosystem, which was a lot more similar along the coast.
Thank you.
I think what I'm hearing, though, is that they want the ability to respond if there's an infestation rather than them coming up and spending $20 million to do a plan. They want to be able to, if you know that something's happening at Sand Lake, like Gage was showing up there, so we're going in and take them out rather than do a plan for the 50,000 lakes or how many lakes we got in Alaska. We have Representative Guerra, and then we're going to go with public testimony.
I share Representative Newman's concern on freshwater, and I probably spend as much water time freshwater fishing for fun as other members of the committee. My only concern is that I don't know if this bill is tailored properly to deal with the freshwater problem. I mean, if you run in and you do an emergency kill of pike, you're not only risking the salmon species, but you're risking rainbow trout, you're risking Dolly Varden, and they do right now have the power to address invasive species in fresh water. They do it. They did it on Watson Lake and those connected lakes down on the Kenai Peninsula near Sterling a few years ago. And I certainly would love there to be some miracle response for pike invasions and things like that. I just don't know if the wording of this bill is the right bill for freshwater, because you might end up doing more damage by doing something on an emergency basis and losing a whole generation worth of rainbow trout and dolly trying to get salmon back, or vice versa. If there is a way for them to improve their response to pike, you know, they're very limited options, that's great, but I just don't know that the wording of this bill is the right bill to do it in.
I do know that I believe the other body put some extra money in for pike control. We had it on the House budget, but I believe this other body increased it. So we want to do public testimony, and I believe we want to address F, if that's – I was hearing that from the co-chair when he left.
I withdrew my objection for adopting the
– Right, but I mean, I think that people want to look at – paragraph or whatever it is on F here. So, Representative Fairclough. Oh.
Mr. Chairman, House Finance staff passed out the original version of House Bill 365. We didn't get the new fiscal note or the old fiscal note. I don't know if those are available. That is what the representative has been talking to us about, the fiscal note of aquatic versus the fiscal note of marine being smaller, but we do have the original bill before us. It's been distributed. Mr. Chairman, we can move into public testimony. It's just more than just F if you're wanting to take it back to the other version. It takes marine out of the entire conversation as far as the statute goes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But aquatic covers it all, too, though, is my understanding. So, with that, we'll go to public testimony. We go to Sitka. Marlene Campbell, are you there? Name and affiliation.
Yes, I am.
Name and affiliation.
Mr. Chairman and members of the Finance Committee, I'm Marlene Campbell. My affiliation is City and Borough of Sitka, and the City and Borough of Sitka is in support of House Bill 365. The first invasive tunicate to hit Alaska shores, that Didenum dexilum you've been hearing about, is now in Whiting Harbor in Sitka. It was identified in June 2010, but was probably here considerably earlier, quite likely introduced with an aquiform that was abandoned many years ago. So it has reproduced pretty substantially at this point. The Department of Fish and Game has done a dive survey and mapped the infestation. It was confined to Whiting Harbor until there was some movement of aquafarm pieces out into the sound, so we're not sure exactly where else, if at all, it has spread. But it's a terrific concern because it does spread potentially all to cover the bottom and wipe out all other species, and could have huge impacts on the Sitka fisheries and habitats for all of our species. There's wide support in Sitka to hire an expert environmental firm to contain and eradicate this invasive, and we're very encouraged about the $500,000 currently in the governor's budget to assist the Department of Fish and Game in moving to actual eradication. We believe it's critical that this in-water eradication begins this summer, not next year or the following year. The risks to Sitka of not acting are extreme, and I think any of you on the coast could extrapolate if the tunicate is spread to your area, because that certainly could happen if it's found around the world at this point. Sitka has the largest harbor system in the state with 5 harbors and 1,326 slips. Fish and Game listing of wholesale value of commercial fisheries to Sitka for the year 2010 was almost $140 million. 19% of Sitka's population is directly involved in the seafood industry. But indirect impacts to Sitka with all of our charter fishers and visitor industry, our world-class salmon fishing, are more like 50% of our economy. And this whole fisheries industry, if lost, could permanently damage our community. Our herring fishery, which is has the largest quota ever this year, could be completely closed down if the DVEC spreads to where it can't be fished without contaminating nets, and that in itself could have devastating consequences. On the East Coast, over 100 miles, actually probably several hundred miles, of prime fishing grounds have been closed to commercial fishing for years because of DVEC, and port and harbors on the West Coast and elsewhere infected with it have never been able to completely eradicate the invasive. Closing Sitka's harbors would have severe economic impacts, and if the invasive spreads, it could move to other ports as well. And containing it at that point would be impossible. Sitka can't wait any longer to eradicate the invasive. House Bill 365, advocating the rapid response to and control of an invasive species when it is in a position like here in Sitka to potentially be contained to just one harbor, is possible, but it requires a rapid response. The fiscal notes with the bill only discuss, that I've seen, only discuss funding to hire Fish and Game staff and do 18-month response plans for the various virulent invasive studies. But immediate action is needed to eradicate this tunicate here in Sitka, which can best be accomplished by emergency action. The more this bill stresses actual emergency response to contain and eradicate the most harmful invasive, not something that's just incidental, but something that really has the potential to cause vast harm to habitats and to our economy, the more effective the bill will be. This bill needs to encourage all state and federal agencies to support a true emergency response to these threats to the state's interests. Thank you for supporting the bill and any assistance to help Sitka and other invaded communities to fight back and destroy virulent invasive species. And thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Marlene. Any questions? Seeing none, thank you again. Kim Elliott from Sitka, are you there? Name and affiliation.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Kim Elliott. I live here in Sitka, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself and my family that lives here in Sitka and has for most of our life. I think Marlene was very thorough in covering the majority of the concerns I have, and so I'm not going to take up a lot of your time. I know that you folks have had some, obviously from your comments, you understand how serious this DVEC issue is, and I am very sympathetic to the other districts that have invasive issues, but, you know, planning is wonderful, but it isn't going far enough. For Sitka, we need action right now. I know that I've been to a lot of different meetings where this has been brought before folks with the Sitka tribe. People are changing the way they're going to gather their herring eggs this year in order to avoid going into an area that has invasive species in it that we don't want to transport it anywhere else. I know that the Port of Fish designated to become a conservation zone for herring includes Whiting Harbor in it. If the GVEC spreads, that's the most likely direction it will go. If it flows through the currents and stuff, that's where it's going to end up. And even though they don't know for sure yet how the herring are going to respond to it, they do know that scallops won't lay their eggs on it because of the acidic nature of the surface. So I can just tell you that we really beseech you to pass this bill and get on with the important part of getting this species eradicated. I thank you very much for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Kim. Questions? Seeing none. Thank you. Heather Woody from Sitka, are you there?
She was unable to attend.
Okay, thank you. Anybody else on the online? Anybody in the audience want to testify? Seeing none, we'll close public testimony. I believe this, the chairman wants to hold this and do some work after listening to the committee and some of the recommendations, Mr. Seaton. So with that, we'll set it aside. We'll take a two-minute break. But before we do, I want to introduce my staff from Haines, Jesse Badger and her mother, Linda Palmer, down here from Haines. So welcome to Juneau. With that, we're in recess.
House Finance come back to order after a brief recess. We have before us CS for House Bill number 212, Transportation. Madam Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I move before the committee the CS for House Bill number 212, Transportation, 27-LS0738-I.
Is there any objection? Or none, that's the working document for the committee. Welcome, Representative Millett.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Sharice Millett. I represent House District 30, Lower Hillside. With me today, I have Jessica Lucan, who is a constituent of District 30, and she's actually carrying the bill, and with your indulgence, I'll let her take over from this point, Mr. Chairman.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jessica Lucan. I'm representing myself. I'd like to begin by thanking the committee for allowing me to testify on behalf of House Bill 212. I'd also like to thank Senator Meyer and his staff, as well as Representative Sharice Millett, for making my project possible. The Alaska Graduated License Program is a three-step program designed to develop safe driving habits, as well as slowly introduce young drivers to Alaskan road system. One of the steps in the program is graduating from an instructional permit to a provisional license. There are some restrictions that follow having a provisional license. Some examples are: you may not carry passengers unless one of the passengers is a person at least 21 years of age. You may carry passengers under the age of 21 only if they are your siblings, and you may not operate a motor vehicle between the hours of 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. unless accompanied by a person at least 21 years of age. Even though these restrictions are in place for young drivers, many choose to ignore these limitations that are there to provide safety to them and other Alaskans. I have a brief PowerPoint presentation that I'd like to present to you.
I just got permission from my co-chair, so it's okay.
I was worried.
Please proceed, Ms. Lucan.
A little over a year ago, in 2011, in February, I had the opportunity to take part in the program Juno Close-Up. The homework beforehand included learning about state and local government, along with presenting a project or idea to our state representative and senator. The product of that project is now House Bill 212. I'd like to explain why student driving is so important to me. 6 years ago, while my father was deployed, my family and I were involved in a head-on car collision caused by a teen driver. This is a photo of our vehicle after we have been pulled out. It is truly a miracle that my whole family survived. Now I feel that it is my responsibility to advocate for safe teen driving. I'd like to point out that out of the 48% of unintentional injuries, 73% of that is motor vehicle traffic accidents in the U.S. These are some Alaska statistics for drivers ages 14 to 16 between 2004 and 2008. I'd like to point out that these statistics show that for drivers ages 14 to 16 in 2004 and 2008, out of the fatal crashes and fatal injuries, that numbers were highest in 2008. Also, if you compute the average numbers of minor injury crashes, major injury crashes, minor injuries, and major injuries, the averages will be higher than the numbers stated in 2008. This means that although it may seem that the numbers are declining, the numbers remain the same. These are a few more statistics for Alaska for drivers ages 16 to 17 between 2002 and 2001. This slide shows that the age and percentage of drivers involved in crashes between 2002 and 2011, but there isn't any information on the effects that the crashes had on the occupants of the other vehicles and the effects that it would have on the public. Provisional licensed drivers are hazardous due to apprehension. Novice drivers are more likely to be nervous due to the fact that they are driving by themselves for the first time. Lack of experience. Many young drivers are known to lack sound judgment because of the lack of experience on the road. Weather conditions, rain, snow, and ice are but a few examples of Alaska's diverse weather conditions. Alaska has no driver's education requirement, and Alaska's diversity from other states. Alaska is known for the vast differences that it has from other states. We have one of the most dangerous roads in America, midnight fishing runs, and we are constantly on the lookout for wildlife. Here's the proposed solution. A person holding a provisional driver's license shall display in the rear window of each vehicle operated by the person a sticker issued by the department that identifies the vehicle that is operated by a provisional licensee. One example of a similar law was passed in New Jersey. Teen drivers with their learner's permit and provisional license are required to display a red decal on the back of their license plate. Similar laws are implemented in New Jersey, British Columbia, Newfoundland, Yukon, and other countries like Australia and England. I've also had information that I haven't done complete research, but I believe there are several other countries that implement this law as well. Here are a few examples of what stickers look like in other places that it is implemented. In Canada, a learner's permit holder uses an L and an N during their equivalent provisional stage. Australia is almost the same, but for the exception of a P during the initial provisional stage. As you can see in the bottom right-hand corner, even the sovereign, Prince William and Catherine, are no exception to abide by British law. So why this solution? This is a simple solution to benefit Alaskan drivers. It will impress other drivers to be more cautious while driving around the novice driver. It will provide other drivers the information necessary to understand the provisional licensee's position, and it will assist law enforcement officers in implementing the law. As the bill states, failure to display a sticker as required by this subsection is an infraction and may be punished by a fine of not more than $200. The enforcement of the bill will impress young drivers on how imperative it is to have the sticker on the back of their vehicle. This is an example of what might take place after the bill is turned into law. The state of Alaska will supply the Department of Motor Vehicles with stickers to distribute to those persons acquiring a provisional license. Those acquiring a provisional license will pay for the sticker as part of the permitting process. The sticker will be placed in the rear window of the operating vehicle. There has been an amendment to remove the rear window and give the DMV flexibility to determine where the most appropriate place would be. In summary, teen drivers with their provisional license are statistically more hazardous to themselves than other Alaskans. I suggest that we require provisional drivers to identify their status and reduce the number of accidents and infractions in Alaska and help save Alaskan lives. I'm open for any questions.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have several, but I can defer. The first one's already been addressed, the tinted windows. In Alaska, there are so many cars that have tinted windows that if anything was in the rear window, you wouldn't see it. So there is a provision that is allowing the department to do it, but we may want to strike just the rear window altogether as far as the form of statute. Jessica, good, great presentation. On page 2, we talk about trying to, lines 15 and 16, we talk about a population, and we say that we'll only issue, if this bill becomes law, that communities under 500 wouldn't have to comply. But we have different parts of our state statutes that talk about communities off the road system, and there are different thresholds, and I'm wondering why we're creating a new one and not using one that's already on the books.
Can you explain the question?
Inside of already in state statute, we define off the road system and we talk about rural communities. Your proposal suggests another threshold, a different number. So in smaller communities, off the road systems for in definitions throughout our code, there are multiple ones, and you're creating a new definition for a threshold, and I'm wondering if a different threshold might be more consistent with state law.
Through the chair to Representative Fairclough, the reason that we did a different threshold, is that what you're calling it? We put it under 500 people because there was questions raised whether this would apply to rural communities because they're exempted from several DMV laws. We put it under 500 people just because there might be a smaller stretch of road, you know, ranging between 5 miles for the rural community, and it might not have applied.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to hear from the Department of Motor Vehicles and see what's consistent for off the road. I'm not sure how this would affect smaller cities that currently do not like some of the restrictions that we place on more urban roads. I'm thinking of Unalaska that has a community that's larger than 500 that's has smaller shorter distance in lane miles. Dillingham, some of the smaller communities may want a different definition. The other issue I'd like to talk about, and Jessica, Representative Millett, we talked about this before I started, so it's not a surprise. We've had a tragic death in our community of a young woman recently, and her body was just discovered. And just so that you know where it's rising in my office is that we've had a mother over the interim this last summer that raised the issue on provisional licenses that and asked our office, wouldn't it be more safe if a young woman, a barista specifically, if her daughter was going back and forth to work, that at least one other person be able to be in the vehicle so that the daughter would be safer, period. It would be safer for two girls to go somewhere than one girl driving by themselves. And the reason I raised the issue of the tragic death that our community is suffering with a family over right now. It was a young woman, a barista, who was alone at night and putting a sticker on a vehicle that is basically shouting out to our community that that is a younger person, male or female, and that they're unaccompanied, based on state statute, could be a call or at least an identification for predators looking for that type of a victim. And so how would you respond in highlighting someone out by themselves, a younger person, and obviously just telling everyone that there are no other people around, at least if you're driving with the sticker and in compliance?
Well, to the trade representative for CLAT, I agree with you. It is definitely a tragedy, and I can't imagine what it would be like to lose someone close to me. But Samantha wasn't underage, and she was a barista. And in that fact, you're going to have sexual predators in any instant. I could have someone follow me in the grocery store or out from the movies. And I like to take precautions when I'm out by myself, checking around where I am, making sure that I'm observing where I am. I was able to talk to the managers for the Special Department of Traffic Safety in New Jersey where this bill is implemented. This question about sexual predators was a big issue when the bill was written and was a piece of legislation in New Jersey. After talking with her, she had said that she had gone and done, there was research done, several surveys done on what the effects would this have on younger adolescents. And she said that they had talked to a special unit from the Highway Patrol or the NJPD, and they didn't have any concerns, only because sexual predators are more likely to use the instrument of the internet. Adolescents are more susceptible because there is so much more information that you can acquire over the internet, such as Facebook or MySpace and social networking pages. So even though this was debated in their legislature, they deemed it unfounded just because they had done the research and they reasoned that because the New Jersey Police Department didn't raise any concerns, they just went ahead and passed it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I ask us to hold the bill. I think we need to do some outreach to see if that's a true statement or not. In our state, we have some of the highest rates of domestic violence, rape, and violence in our community. We have the Covenant House that's located downtown, and specifically for Anchorage and the police department, while I serve locally, the highest incidence of those acts of violence were in our downtown area, with perpetrators moving into the downtown area and circulating up and down 4th and 5th Avenue, waiting for an opportunity to present itself. But I'm not trying to kill the bill. I just need 24 hours to make some phone calls to Covenant House, to Standing Together Against Rape, and to Awake in the shelters to see if we can get any kind of feedback from our communities quickly to see if if they believe it's a non-issue or not. And we may have testimony that can speak to that now. Mr. Chairman, my last question for the moment is, we have a small community like Anchor Point that has a population of under 500. So in that particular community, you wouldn't be required to place a sticker on your vehicle, but that particular community, I guess it wouldn't qualify because it's on the road system. Is that correct? I'm getting a nod. So that would be okay. It would be more a smaller community that might get on the ferry and come into the system. So you could be off of the road system, get on a ferry, and then be actually a driver on the system. Is that correct, Ms. Lucan?
Through the chair, yes, it is.
Okay.
If I might respond to Representative Faircloth's previously raised question, I was able to talk to a member of the APD, actually several members of the APD. I did my research to find out if it was a problem, whether the victims of sexual assault knew their attackers or didn't know their attackers. I got some feedback on that. They said that some sexual predators took the opportunity, such as date rape. They also gave examples that the statistics are higher for victims who know their attackers, such as uncles or fathers. So when you're just doing your research, I'd like you to take that into consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There, for the committee, there's a study done by ICER that the APD response rates are out there, and what Jessica is relaying is correct. Typically, there is not someone jumping out of the bushes, per se, that you typically, I believe it's 70 to 80% of the cases, you know the person who's attacking you. But that doesn't mean you know them as a friend. It means that you may have met them in a bar or went willingly to a hotel room and that you've made a smaller acquaintance. But there is a study out there. I just asked the committee for overnight to see if I can contact those particular nonprofits that work with crime victims to see if it's an issue for them and see if we can get letters of support to move the bill along. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, and speaking of stickers, I know the state of Florida, and it might have been before you were born, back tourists coming from airports and rental car agencies, the dead giveaway is that they were not able to take advantage of the Florida right to carry. So they knew they were unarmed. That's what gangs targeted was rental cars with very visible rental car stickers. And the state of Florida actually ended up taking the stickers off as a public policy. So there is some credence to what Representative Faircloth is saying. I was trying to listen as I was in my other meeting, trying to keep up. And Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'd like to see some other statistics as well on just drivers. I'm a mother of three boys and a girl, and got that sticker shock when they told me how much it would cost me insurance-wise when they were there. And you know, I know by statistics until males, you know, are usually 25 or married, are the highest risk. So I would be really interested in knowing what the difference in statistics are between this age bracket and that one. And I'm not picking on the males, but they do tend to drive fast and do other things that bring them into that market. I would also be interested, since you use New Jersey as an example, I don't know how long that they've had a provisional, but do they have statistics that show that it really has dropped? And do they have driver's education to where, I guess I'm just trying to figure out, unless you think that sticker is going to make other drivers stay far away from those vehicles, and since it's dark, especially in the North Pole area more than it's light, especially during the winter, I'm just trying to figure out whether a lot of the accidents are just inexperienced because of the ice and the conditions, and how that would change with a sticker. I mean, I just guess I need a correlation, so, you know, I like
to. Chair, Representative Wilson, the goal of the bill is to provide new drivers the allowance of maybe a wider berth from more experienced drivers around them so that they can recognize, okay, this is a novice driver, someone who's new, and that they'll be respectful and give them more room on the road, also take more precautions because, like I said before, the novice driver lacks sound judgment because they haven't had the same experience. Also, it will aid law enforcement officers in identifying those teen drivers who might be carrying more passengers. I know that there's problems, and I called all the Anchorage schools and the Anchorage School District also out in Eagle River and Wasilla. There's a big problem with students with their provisional license taking their peers to lunch or after school, which is where most of accidents occur for team drivers. So those are the goals of the bill.
Follow-up, sir.
Representative Wilson.
I'm really concerned if we're going to use this as a way for police to be pulling people over mm-hmm. versus, you know, for the safety because they're of the drive, and that's what I'm hearing from you. You know, my kids were like 18, 19, 20, 21, you know, 14, 15, so I'd have to have that sticker on all my vehicles, and so my older ones would be getting pulled over unless they always remember to remove it and put it on another vehicle, and we've tried that during the university days and got quite a few tickets for not being able to remember. But that's the part that really concerns me about this bill, because I feel it's a way for police to pull people over because of that sticker versus a safety issue, you know, and I don't think they should be pulling them over just because of a sticker and making sure that they are abiding by certain rules if everything else they're doing is okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
I think Representative Wilson, on subsection C, there is a provision. It's a secondary offense as I read that. If that has, I probably missed that.
I appreciate the presentation, and I'm being facetious here, though truthful, which is when my friend's kids turn 16, I call them and I ask them, give me a call when they're about to get on the road, so I know. That's the way I deal with it. But
To the chair, to address Representative Wilson, like Representative Stoltz said, there was that new subsection added. The other concern that you had is whether, there would be, if the student would remember to pull off the sticker and put it back on the car. Most teenagers don't understand, but driving is a privilege, and it is not a privilege, and it's a responsibility. So, that teen driver will have to go through those checklists like they do every time they enter the car. Are my lights working? Are my turn signals working? Do I have my license? Everything else that they need to get on the road. So that's what I would do to address your comment, is the fact that, you know, it doesn't enforce responsibility for that new student driver.
Mr. Chair, she will be a mother one day, and she will probably more understand what we're trying to say. And I understand from your position, and I always hope that for my children, and someday even their 20s, they'll get it. But you'll understand in a few years.
So through the chair, I'm from a family of five, so...
I just sent a message to Representative Wilson. My adolescent days from 16 to 25, I said, the devil made me do it. There was a comedian, remember? Used to say that. The devil made me do it.
Apparently old enough to remember. Representative Newman. And then,
right? I've seen him while I was watching the movie while I was driving down the road. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Whatever you say can and will be used against you. Please save me.
I applaud the carrier of this bill for the effort. But, again, as a parent with two kids who are 20-something, low 20s, but when it talks about a probable cause and it being a secondary offense, I believe that when we passed House Bill 381, which is mandatory seatbelts, that was intended to be a secondary. Now we see Clicket or Ticket commercials all over where it's a primary offense. And it was first looked at as being a secondary. Now it's primary, a reason to pull you over. My daughter calls herself a police magnet. You know, she refers to him as Popo. Because she's younger. I mean, she is pulled over. She gets pulled over because there's rocks in the tire, and the cops say, well, we thought you had studded tires. My son got pulled over on a dirt road in front of our house because there's two lights on the tail on the license plate, and one of them was out. Got pulled over. They just attract cops for that reason. And how do we ensure that, again, we're not making a second class out of our youth? I mean, you go to driver's education. I wish we had driver's education in the state mandatory, and the schools are at least available. I think more students would do it. I think that would take care of this issue a lot. I did. I went through driver's education. But my kids are good drivers. They have never been in an accident. How do we not set them up as a separate class? They've gone to DMV, passed all the requirements that are required by the state currently to operate a motor vehicle. We already have certain regulations on what they can and cannot do. But how do you, taking away their rights, you know, is how I see this. It's somewhat taking away their rights. You have to have a sign in your back window, and I'm also concerned, again, with making them targets. I'm very, very concerned about that because it's happened to my wife before it followed it. How do we address those concerns about not making these another class of person that have to do special things, although they've already passed all the laws, because they're youth?
Through the chair to Representative Mooney, I'm not trying to put anybody in a specific class or trying to lump bad drivers with good drivers. My goal is actually to keep, you know, your children and other people's children safe from drivers who might be aggressive, who might get angry. I know when I first was learning how to drive, I would get fearful because somebody was honking at me when I wasn't turning at the right time, or because I was trying to pull out in front of me. So I think that with this, drivers will be more considerate to that teen driver who might be having apprehension or nervousness or just being new to the road. So that's the goal, not to lump people in a subsection or discriminate them as a class. It's for safety, and I hope it will save lives. And you can't measure prevention. You know, this can't be measured because it's never been done in any other. It's been done in New Jersey, but it's so new that they don't have the information available to show that it is improving. I've talked to several people from that state, and they say it is improving, but they just don't have the statistics to show it because it passed so recently.
Mr. Chair, I also have concerns on effort. I know we had concerns from people in the Big Lake community on response time from troopers, response time to somebody who was being abused in the parking lot, getting beat up. And you know, when you talk to the troopers, they say, well, we're maybe stopping a student driver because they didn't have their student driver. We only have so many Alaska State Troopers, too. So there's a public safety issue dealing with all this. And road conditions play into accidents, nighttime. When I see that shrunk up little old man driving that 40,000-pound motorhome for 65 miles an hour down the highway, I have concerns, you know, who can barely walk. You know, I applaud your effort, but I'm very concerned, and I'm not won over yet on why we should, what I think is to infringe on other people's rights, lawfully went and got a driver's license. So I don't know if you can change my mind quickly or not.
Yep, till tomorrow. Representative Dugan and then Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I wanted to say that I'm in favor of this piece of legislation. Not the least of my reasons is that you did a fine job presenting it. And I have my own experience to fall back on. By the time I started driving when I was 16, by the time I was 19, I'd wrecked three buggies, and it had killed two horses, Mr. Speaker, or Mr. Chairman. So I have personal experience.
Impressed the heck out of the equine community.
I have actual experience with the question of whether or not young people drive as safely as old fogies like I am now. And so I think that this is a great idea if we can work out the details of it. Thank you.
Representative Edgman.
Well, the longer I sit here, the more I learn how distinguished my colleagues are. A couple of points. One, in response to Representative Newman's questions to you, which I thought were good points, might you argue the converse in the sense that if you did have a younger driver get pulled aside with this the sticker on it appropriately placed on the vehicle, wouldn't the law enforcement officer be more perhaps accommodating to the fact that somebody was actually doing what they're supposed to do. And, you know, at this stage where learning how to drive, maybe they know all of the rules, but there's still some finer points of driving that they haven't yet mastered. And maybe it's a situation where you do have a light out, like you described, Reverend Newman. That really shouldn't be an infraction, but when he gets pulled over by a law enforcement officer, there'd be some sense that, hey, you know, this person is kind of coming along a little bit and maybe isn't deserving of a ticket. But have you encountered that in any of your research for the bill?
No, but I have experience being pulled over, and I know that when I was terrified because, you know, I have to go and face my parents. And so I think that because you have that sticker on the back, the officer will be a little bit more gracious and a little bit more careful how he addresses you because he knows that you're new and maybe it was a small infraction. So I think he would, in a scenario like that, I think there would be a possibility that they would address it differently than a more experienced driver.
Representative Etchen, follow up.
And through the chair, just a separate question would be, as well, during your work on the bill, did you encounter any insurance cost savings in the state of New Jersey or elsewhere for doing this?
I didn't look into the state of New Jersey, but I did call several more known insurance companies and asked if there was any reduction in premium increase or the cost of insurance for student drivers. They had never heard of anything like that, but I did get one feedback that said if other insurance companies started doing something like this, then they would jump on the bandwagon.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. To my friend across the way, who's buggies couldn't survive either. I don't think horses can read, nor can they tell colors. Just on that note, but more to the bill and more to you. You know, it's funny because we often want our younger population to accept responsibility and be more responsible. And you're offering a way to do that, and I think that is to be commended. And often are wanting to accept more responsibilities at an earlier age. So I, being the father of five daughters and a son, also family of five, I can appreciate your efforts. You've been very thorough. But I look forward to what else we might find out by tomorrow's time. To me, it's not lost that you're accepting of those responsibilities. And I'd just like to say, at least from one person, thank you for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Jill. Are there questions from committee members? With that, Ms. Lucan, do you have any closing comments? We're going to set the bill aside. I already sent my staff out of the room. We will be taking public testimony. I've sent my staff out of the room, but before we move to public testimony, do you have a final comment for the committee?
I do, thank you. I understand that no bill is perfect, and in each legislation it comes down to the benefit outweighing the cost. And in this instance, I do believe that the cost will be someone's life and that the benefit will be saving lives. And I know that through all these amendments and through all your questions, it does urge me to do more research and try to answer them as best as I can, so I appreciate that. And I appreciate the fact that we try to get this bill as close to perfect as possible. Thank you.
Ms. Lucan, I might add that we try not to love a bill to death or make it too perfect in an effort. So we take that note seriously. Mr. Chairman, I'll turn the gavel back over to you. I understand we have a couple people waiting to testify.
We have people here for information. We have the director of Division of Motor Vehicles and one of our top troopers. I think we probably get their comments on, even though they're sometimes reticent to give them, we can probably coax them out of them. Ms. Brewster, are you online?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Whitney Brewster, Director of the Division of Motor Vehicles. I'd just like to give some general background information for the committee. The DMV currently has approximately 600-250 unexpired provisional license holders in our system.
600 to 150, that math. Can you repeat those numbers?
600 6,250.
Oh, 6,000. I'm sorry. That was my deficiency in hearing. I apologize.
Oh, no problem. We have attached a zero fiscal note to this bill. In our research, we have found that the approximate cost of a static claim decal is about 20 cents, and with the number of provisional license holders, it would cost the DMV less than $1,000 a year to offer these stickers. So it would be a fairly inexpensive and easy program to administer if it was the legislature's wish for us to do so.
Yeah, where were you when you were doing my fiscal notes? Okay, please proceed.
To address Representative Fairclough's specific question about rural exemptions, there are rural exemptions for the issues of vehicle registration and insurance requirements, as well as CDL, commercial driver licenses, in communities that are off the road system and have a daily traffic volume of 499 or less. Those numbers are kept by the Department of Transportation. It's my understanding that there were some legislators who were concerned that there are parts of the state that do not meet that exemption that would be impacted by this bill. For instance, Angoon is one of those communities. They have a daily traffic volume of over 499. And so in an effort to exempt communities such as those from these requirements, that is why the population of 500 was inserted into this particular part of the statute.
Ms. Brewster, is this because we don't have the other language about the traffic count and the road system? This is a more relaxed requirement?
Mr. Chairman, this will address more communities that may have a high daily traffic volume, but that are very much considered rural. Cake and Goon are two of those communities. The issue when it comes to, we do have restricted Class D licenses, and those are for communities that are not connected to the land highway and do not have access to a DMV office. For instance, Dillingham and Unalaska, I believe Representative Fairclough addressed, those communities both have a DMV office, but areas of the state like Angoon certainly do not. And so, To really focus on those communities that are not easily able to get to a DMV office, they would not be required to have the provisional sticker on their vehicle.
Questions for Ms. Brewster? Thank you for joining us. We'll go to Lieutenant Dial.
For the record, my name is Rodney Dial. I'm a lieutenant with the troopers stationed in Ketchikan. The department puts a high priority on highway safety, and we certainly appreciate the efforts of Ms. Lukin to make our roads safer. The department is neutral on this bill, and I just wanted to make myself available for any questions.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your service, Rodney. I have some trepidation about identifying young drivers and then telling people around the community that they're driving by themselves. Do you have any thoughts about that for your community or for communities across the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Fairclough, we have thought about that. It could be a concern. However, the department at this point really has no basis to form an opinion on that.
Thank you. Those final comments just for the committee. Some of our smaller villages have fairly high rates of child abuse, and anyway, it just remains a concern of mine that we're going to say that there are youth out there or young drivers that are by themselves. I guess that's I'll deal with that. Thank you.
He's neutral. Are you neutral on the issue Representative Faircliff raised about the potential safety?
Mr. Chairman, is that a question for me?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask one more time, because it is.
Mr. Chairman, that is certainly a concern that we have. I can tell you personally that there is probably no crime that is more of a concern to a law enforcement officer than that involving a young person. We see that as one of our highest duties to protect what we see as, you know, the innocent members of our society in many cases. I can tell you that if this was this legislation passed, we would definitely do our part to try to determine if there were any unintended consequences with the passage of this legislation, and if so, we would certainly bring those to the attention of the legislature. We would hope that would not be the case. You know, we're all very aware of the student driver signs that we see on cars across the state. I'm not quite sure that that would be that big of an issue, and the actual amount of time that this decal would be required on vehicles is somewhat limited, so that would be a benefit as well. But that would be something that we would have a concern of and would watch for.
You're far enough in your career. You probably remember the Florida dynamic with the tourists and rental cars, Lieutenant Dial.
Mr. Chairman, I do remember that. And I remember that, just like you said, the gangs were targeting tourists, and I believe there was actually a few deaths associated with that, as I recall, which actually led to, as you said, the removal of those identifying marks and rental cars.
Especially coming out of the international airports, I believe is my recollection, because they knew very unlikely that a German tourist was going to be have traditional southern defense mechanisms. Representative Faircliff.
Mr. Chairman, this might be for the Department of Law, and I don't mean this tongue-in-cheek, though it might sound like it, but we have drivers that are out there that have multiple violations of drunk driving on their record, and we're still allowing them to drive. And so if we had a, whatever this sticker looks like, could we put a sticker on somebody's car that said that they'd been convicted of drunk driving charges? And while that might sound tongue-in-cheek, more what I'm trying to get to, is there a anything constitutional that will prohibit us from identifying a driver that has a higher potential of being in an accident or causing an accident? Because that's what we're talking about. I mean, I support the concept. Actually, off the record, I can tell you a story of how my children believe I am the sole person responsible for youth having provisional driver's licenses, period, in the state of Alaska, even though I wasn't elected at the time, but they dared me. So ask me off the record. But anyway, I'd like to hear from the Department of Law I guess I can check with the Civil Liberties Union to see if I know that we designate based on age on a driver's license in the state of Alaska, but just wonder if there's any other legal consequences that we should be aware of. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
That's for the Anchorage Assembly where they ask permission in the ACLU. I don't do that here.
No.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you, Lieutenant Dial. Well, we will I appreciate the dialogue on this bill. I apologize for having to exit several times back and forth. There's a couple other issues we're dealing with in the legislative process that are dividing my attention. So it's not a matter of disrespect leaving the process. I want to apologize to those of the public watching me leave in and out. Don't have a bladder problem.
Yeah.
So we'll set this bill aside and we'll endeavor to get this back tomorrow. So thank you, Ms. Lucan. We'll set this bill aside, take a brief at ease.
A measure for which we have a House Finance Committee substitute before us. Madam Vice Chair.
Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for House Bill number 294, Finance, 27-LS1108-D, dated 4-4-2012, before the committee.
I'd like to invite Mr. Michelle to briefly describe the committee substitute, so I'll object to that purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Co-Chair, my name is Joe Michelle, staff to House Finance. The change in the CS before the committee for version D adds a Section 3 to the legislation. And what Section 3 does is it adds conditional language. That means if the bill passes, it would not take effect unless there was an appropriation of $150 million or more into the PCE Endowment Fund. That appropriation would have to happen during this 27th legislature.
Would that be considered spending or savings?
That is a great question.
Savings.
Well, they call it savings in other parts.
The other body is savings.
But that's leaving that rhetorical question in the air. We will see if I'll remove my objection. Is there any other objection? The CS is before us as a working document for the committee. Welcome, Representative Edgman, to that part of the room.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Bryce Edgman. I represent House District 37. This bill would amend the commercial fishing revolving. Oh, sorry.
They missed it. Oh, yeah.
This won't take like 3 minutes.
Representative Edgman, please continue.
My turn. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, in all seriousness, what I'll do is just maybe take a couple of minutes just to describe the bill. It's pretty basic in its concept, and perhaps that would generate some questions in terms of getting into more of the details behind the bill and the program itself. The Power Cost Equalization Program has been around since 1984, and in its present iteration, it provides essentially relief for rural consumers. Electricity side of the equation, not the space heating side, but the electricity side of the equation, up to 500 kilowatt hours per month for those utilities that are eligible. The formula is based on both fuel and non-fuel costs. Eligible communities are determined by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. The program is monitored vis-a-vis monthly reports to the Alaska Energy Authority, and with a $400 million appropriation in July of 2011, last year, the PC endowment is now somewhere within the neighborhood of $700 million. And I'll close by saying that I'm under no illusions. This is a major piece of legislation. It's got a hefty price tag attached to it. But I bring it forward in the spirit of doing something major for rural consumers and prices of energy that are just going to the roof to the point of changing the demographics in a lot of our rural communities. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'll maybe step
aside. Can you discuss the broadening of it? That's really the
substance. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
I think that's the real substance.
Absolutely. I should have done that. What the bill proposes to do is to expand that monthly cap from 500 kilowatt hours to 600 kilowatt hours, and as well allow commercial
or the residential
website. And on the commercial side, it would bring the commercial consumers back into the program, but with a limitation of about 600 kilowatt hours a month, and as well an overall use per month of 2,400 kilowatt hours. The bill would also exempt state and federal facilities and non-residential consumers of the particular utility that's been deemed to be eligible by the RCA. So that really in a nutshell is what the bill is all about.
So with reading this says, I mean, very small businesses?
It would be, Mr. Chairman. I met with the governor about this bill a couple of days ago, and he asked me about the benefits of it on the commercial side, and I said, well, in my district, it would be the the barber shop in Alaska or the coffee shop in Sandpoint, or it would be the bed and breakfast in Togiak, the mom and pop store in Manicotic. It would be that type of a benefit that this bill would largely provide. Because a lot of, about 60% of the overall, the 190 utilities or so that participate in this, most of the communities don't even get to the 60% mark of using that 500 kilowatt hour cap. And so this bill is certainly offered in the spirit of allowing residential users to get benefits up to 600, an additional 100 kilowatt hours a month. But more so, it's designed to allow for the commercial entities in the smaller communities to have some relief in terms of providing electricity in an era of really high costs.
And Representative Edwards, this is an education process for not only us, but the general public watching it. Why don't you describe some square footage houses and traditional kilowatt-hour uses? I think you have a mission representing your region that's educational as well. And you've taken that on. That's why I'm not trying to assign it to you.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. There are others behind me who hopefully will get to testify at some point who can certainly get in much more detail. But what I'd like to do is just sort of quickly talk about what a small rural community looks like with a utility that has fixed costs that are spread over a small utility base, small consumer base, having to barge in diesel, having to...
Please have latitude just to be able to tell us your story.
But as a result, pay electricity costs that are, you know, 3 to 4 times what the average rate might be for Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, which is a number that is tied into the overall PC formula. So the beneficiaries of this program, will be small rural consumers who, for the most part, don't get that 500 kilowatt-hour cap, I'm repeating myself, but who have smaller dwellings, who perhaps use a local laundromat instead of having a washer and a dryer in their own home and don't use that electricity. They go to a centralized facility. I'll just leave it at that.
I assume you're more acutely aware of how much you use if you use an electrical appliance, what that's going to be if you're on a... I'm not trying to pry it out of you, but I was trying to take advantage of your presence here.
Well, the Institute of Social and Economic Research did a really great study, very detailed study that was just released about a week ago or so, about all the communities that are participating and what the rates are in the summer and in the winter and the overall usages are and what the averages are. And it's pretty revealing because at first blush, this program has been accused of being, by some, to be an entitlement, a handout, or, subsidy, or whatever the term might be. But as it turns out, a lot of the smaller communities don't utilize it as much as one would think. And furthermore, because, as we discussed in a bill a couple of weeks ago about the large turnover of local administrators and the stringent reporting requirements that are involved in this, that a lot of these small communities perhaps could utilize it more if they kept up with the reporting and if they actually were more in touch with the opportunities that the program provides on a monthly basis. So, the fiscal note, which hopefully we'll get into here at some point, talks about a price tag of annually about $20 million. But in my estimation, that is very clearly on the high end. It's if all those rural consumers use every kWh that they possibly could, when in fact we've got pretty hard data that shows that they don't even come close in terms of most of the communities. And very predictably, the larger usage takes place in the northern part of the state, as well as surprisingly sort of in the southern part of the state. We've seen a lot of kWh benefits apply to communities here in the southeast that, of course, are on diesel and are isolated, aren't on any kind of an intertie system with in terms of a overall grid. So I put the bill forward. I'm hoping to have a good discussion on it. I think it's a way to help make a dent in the overall soaring energy costs for Alaska. Again, I'm under no pretense that this is going to go out and equalize the field in terms of energy costs, whether it's on the electricity side or the space heating side. This will, again, make a little bit of a dent, and it'll be greatly appreciated. And I'm hoping to bring awareness to the benefits that this bill will provide, but also how dire it is out there in rural Alaska in terms of the energy situation. It's only getting worse.
Thank you. Questions for Representative Gara.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Edgerman, I'm supportive of the bill. And we had talked and talked to some other offices. The ISO report also had recommended some ways to maybe there's this sort of catch-22 of power cost equalization is very much needed, but there's not a huge incentive for folks to engage in energy efficiency to save energy. It's a conundrum. And ICER had a recommendation in their report. It's complex. There's not enough time in session to deal with it. I understand that. But I'm just hoping that in the future we can take a look at something reasonable that might add a cost savings component to PCE. But it'll be complex.
Through the chair, if I may, Representative Gara. Thanks to a seven-hour floor session that we had recently here, I won't mention the bill. I did get through the entire 80-page report, so I read the whole thing. Then I read it some more, and so I know enough to have forgotten most of it. But what I did, in terms of the efficiency side, first off, the state's put a lot of money into weatherization, so we've been able to, make a lot more homes efficient out in rural Alaska as well as urban Alaska. But we're just starting that program. Some $300 million or $400 million into it really is maybe at the 10% mark or some small number in terms of weatherization. In terms of the efficiency of the program, the PCE formula itself really is built so that if fuel costs go down, then so does the PCE benefit. And I bring that up because the Renewable Energy Grant Fund program, we passed a bill in here about a month ago or so to extend the reauthorization of that program, has provided in 2011 about $6 million in terms of energy costs that have been displaced by renewable energy products that have come online. Most of that $6 million in savings, unfortunately, can be attributed to two projects, one in Gustavus Falls Creek Hydroelectric Project and Pillar Creek and Pillar Mountain Wind Project in Kodiak. But there's still been a lot of other wind turbine systems in western Alaska that have contributed to the overall grid that have helped reduce the PCE costs, supplemental in nature, if you will. So that in combination, I probably should have started off by saying that the reporting requirements are very stringent. Every month, these utilities have to report to AEA how much kilowatt hours have been generated by the utility, how much fuel has been consumed, what those costs are. I think they even have to provide individual customer ledgers. So the efficiency standard in there has been built in over the years. I think that concern, if Representative Thomas was here, he might talk about it as well, has been ongoing. And if you look at Title 42, there's also provisions in there that speak to the fact that the Alaska Energy Authority, or RCA, one of the two, I can't remember now, has the ability to require even more information from utilities, as well as not allowing certain expenses to be written off while applying for the PCE benefit. So a long-winded answer to say that I agree with what you're saying, but as well that there has been some progress in terms of the program to address that concern.
Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you by any chance know on average how much a household saves if they use the 500 kilowatts? I know it depends upon which area you're talking about, but overall, do you have any idea?
Through the chair, the overall number is that the PCE program saves, for those utilities that participate, about 30% of the overall electricity costs that are within the first 500 kilowatt hours, and I may be guilty of oversimplifying it, but the general number is about a third. And I would ask Mira or perhaps Sarah Fisher go to give you a more thorough answer than that.
I think my other question is probably you need to be directed that way, so on that, thank you.
With those folks wishing to testify, I had sign up sheets for just some people that are off nets and in Dillingham. Can staff bring up any other sign-up sheets, sir? So,
playing blind here, not knowing everybody signed up. We've adjusted our time a little bit. We'll go right into the public testimony then. Why don't we, we'll take the folks that have been off-net and online. I imagine the folks in Dillingham will want to go home sometime tonight. So, is Val Anguson in Dillingham at the LIO office?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair, thank you for your opportunity to participate in this oral public hearing process. My name is Val Anguson. I'm the Deputy Director of the Bristol Bay Housing Authority. We encompass a region from Ivanhoe Bay on the Alaska Peninsula to Peterborough Bay, Dilly on the Lake, to the Clay McGillingham Togiak area on the north side of the Bristol Bay, about 40,000 square miles. The Bristol Bay Housing Authority supports this bill, committee substitute 294, which allows for an increase from 500 to 600 kilowatt hours per month, and to extend the eligibility to small commercial users. It can be safely said that growth opportunity in rural Alaska is at a virtual standstill due to high costs of gasoline, heating fuel, and other goods. As a result of those increased transportation costs. And just to give you an example, we're probably talking about a local market rate of about $10 a gallon for milk, $6 a gallon for gas. That's in a hub community. You can imagine the cost in the smaller villages. Restaurant customers and highway traffics are no longer similar to prior 2008 levels. This is a solid indication that surplus income may be non-existent. As you know, hub communities, including Dillingham, have demand in excess of 2,000 population. However, most rural communities are much smaller, resulting in much higher costs. And until alternative technologies have had a chance to become more marketable in rural Alaska, which they are coming up, hearing rumors about net zero homes along the rail belt. The PCE program will be extremely critical in itself and also for businesses to exist and grow. Hopefully savings will be passed on to customers. And Mr. Chair, and as well as the other co-chairs of the committee, Madam Co-Chair, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Angus. Any questions? Want to send a greeting home, Representative Richmond?
Well, thanks for the testimony, Val. I appreciate that. I was just, somebody told me that the price of gas in Dillingham, at least in one of the local stations, actually risen to $7.23 a gallon. We had gotten a couple calls on that, so just even getting more acute, I think, as time goes on.
Thank you very much, Representative. And thank you, Mr. Anguson. Next we'll go to Cake.
You're welcome.
Thank you, sir. We'll go to Cake, Robbie Garrett. Are you still there, Mr. Garrett?
Yes, I am. Mr. Chairman and committee, thank you very much for giving this time to talk to you. I am a manufacturer in Cake. My wife and I own a company, and we manufacture dry bags, and we sell them globally. We employ three people plus ourselves, and we're definitely interested in the bill as far as power goes.
Very succinct, sir. Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Garrett? Thank you for waiting and holding on so long, sir.
Oh, sure. I might give you some information. I heard somebody ask before about it. In the rural area, especially such as Cake, our rates are rather high, especially when we can't fall under the non-commercial clause. We are building. We only use about two households worth of power. But at our rate right now, our base rate is about 54 cents a kilowatt. But our effective rate, which in business would be when you take all the other costs that are on the card they send you, add them together, and then divide by kilowatt hours, is up around 85 cents a kilowatt. And this makes it even more difficult to manufacture and do it profitably. And it's not just our operation, but we have a small oyster farm that does processing and would fall under these new categories of electricity, and also a small woodworking operation. So we would look at this not as a subsidy to go on forever, but rather as a bridge from now till we can get an inner tire and more stable, low-cost electrical.
Thank you very much for that.
If there's any questions I could answer, I'd sure be glad to.
No, I appreciate the addendum information you provided. That's helpful, sir. So thank you very much, Mr. Garrett.
Thank you.
Here in Juneau, Mira Kohler. It's the all-star testimony we've been waiting for.
Thank you. My name is Mira Kohler, and I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Village Electric Cooperative. And I'm here to testify in favor of adoption of House Bill 294. As you're probably aware, AVEC, which is what we're commonly known as, serves 54 communities in Alaska with electricity. We sell about 74 million kilowatt hours a year, so that's a pretty modest number. It translates to about 1.3 million kilowatt hours per community per year. Representative Edgman has four communities that we serve in his region, and we serve most of the Nana villages up in the northwest. The average residential consumption in our villages is about 400 kilowatt hours on a year-round basis. It varies widely between regions. As a practical matter, it is higher in the northwest because they have pipe water and sewer systems, and so that those systems use electricity, and that drives up their consumption. In many of our communities, we have a real serious hardship in the winters because even though in the summer a consumer may only use 200 or 300 kilowatt hours or even less, in the winter they very regularly go above 500 kilowatt hours just because you're using your stove more, you're using your lights more. It's still a fraction of what's used in urban Alaska. The homes are smaller. On average, you'd ask the question, they're 1,000 to 1,200 square feet on the high side. There are a lot of places that are less than 600 square feet, so they are very modest consumers. We also have about 2,800 commercial customers. Out of those, we figure about half would be eligible for PCE because they would be under the limit in this bill of 2,400 kilowatt hours per month. My calculations based upon our consumption, and we do represent almost a third of all PCE used in the state of Alaska. Our consumption we expect for eligible kilowatt hours would go up about between 35 and 40% if you were to pass this bill. I know that AEA has computed the fiscal note and it's slightly higher than that, but they're being a little conservative, which we expect them to be. And I understand that. As a practical matter, the balance in the PCE endowment fund as of the end of last month is about $780 million. And, of course, it hasn't been that way for very long because we just had a recent $400 million injection into the fund. But over a period of...
What was the other big injection? Was it around 2005 or so? Was that
The endowment fund was adopted in 2000, and $100 million was put in there then from the CBR. Then we got the proceeds from the Fort Dam pool sale a year later. That was another $85 million. Then we had $182 million, $187 million that Governor Murkowski put in. When was that? 2005.
And that was my reference question.
Right. So, you know, obviously...
It seemed like a big number then.
It did. $400 million was quite an eye-opener. So as a practical matter, if the market continues to stay relatively modest...
Just hold sanity for just a second. with all the sirens passed.
All right, back to Representative Edgewood just showed me that it was 2006. You were correct.
Right. I see.
So anyway,
it's a different dirty deal.
both you and I are in trouble. So
the reality is
I wasn't involved with.
That the endowment fund would spin off technically enough to cover the expanded PCE under 294 after a period of about 4 years. So I think maybe I should hold off on saying any more and respond to questions.
Any questions for Ms. Kohler? Representative, Mr. Co-Chair.
When is enough enough?
Never.
Or enough.
Well, you know, the point is that the effective rate for our residential consumers for the first 500 kilowatt hours is about 21.5 cents a kilowatt hour. That's for about half of our kilowatt hour sales. Everybody else is paying full fare. So until there is a solution for rural Alaska so that all of our electricity is down to a reasonable level, which I would say would be somewhere in the 10 to 20 cent a kilowatt hour range, it'll never be enough because our communities are gasping for breath. Energy is killing them. The cost of energy is killing them.
One more comment here. We all know that oil production is going down and eventually we're going to be in a deficit. Aren't you? Some feel that the PCE fund could be in danger because it would be like low-hanging fruit.
Representative Thomas, through the chair, you're absolutely right. This is predicated upon there continuing to be an adequate revenue stream, but I'm very optimistic that we will design and hopefully put in place an all-Alaska solution that's going to provide affordable energy across the state of Alaska. That has to be our mission.
That sounds like a practice speech, but yes. But I mean, unless you get production up here, revenue sharing, everything else that people want is still going to be a problem. And then when people like this time of year need a $50 million, $100 million to just reach into that pool.
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Mr. Benjamin.
I think that's a good point that Representative Thomas brings up because clearly this comes with a pretty huge price tag. I'm not trying to sidestep that at all. But when I look at what's happening out in rural Alaska, we're just in the middle of a redistricting process. There's enough population now in all of rural Alaska to comprise 3.7 house districts. That number is a lot smaller than it was 10 years ago. 10 years down the road, that 3.7 house districts number is going to be even smaller. So I think it's a policy call amongst us as legislators. What do we want rural Alaska to look like going forward, and understand that the cornerstone of any type of a healthy sustainability in rural Alaska is tied to energy. And I guess I would always argue, and clearly I've got a biased point of view because I am from rural Alaska, that there's very much a symbiotic relationship between our major hubs in the state as well as our rural communities. They're on the list, everything from freight to transportation to fuel to cost of goods and services. That economic multiplier does impact urban areas as well. So it's a policy call. There's no answer for it. And there's no also glossing over the fact that this involves a fair amount of money.
With those small numbers, it's been urban Democrats and Republicans that have supported that PCE. It hasn't happened with the small representative. Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was kind of thinking back when oil started to climb, and we really didn't notice it till it kind of went over the $100 mark. And that was an anomaly. And how many years ago did that anomaly occur and has not really corrected itself? Or maybe it has on a world level where it's just staying above 100 miles an hour or $100 a barrel. And I think yesterday or something was at 122. And And as we kind of move forward, it's kind of spread into the whole state. I mean, everybody's energy costs are going up. Gas isn't cheap anymore, so the Anchorage Bowl feels it, and certainly Fairbanks feel it. So energy has become a huge huge issue for us, and I think we've been very creative in being able to corral some money. And yes, we're spending money, but we're doing it by leveraging, corralling a bunch of it and working the interest on some of the projects looking forward. I understand we're going to need to actually spend real money to get energy to all parts of Alaska, but at least in this point right now, it's creating a different kinds of savings so that you're using the interest, and I think that's being very creative.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are there any energy projects that are going on right now to in any of the villages that you represent that is going forward that may lower your costs?
Through the Chair, Representative Wilson, we actually are, we own more wind turbines in operation today than any other company in the state. So we have some 34 wind turbines that are actually operating in 12 villages and that serve 15 villages. We have been pretty aggressive. We've been very aggressive with that, and I will point out to you that in our latest PCE filing, which occurred in December of last year, the village with the lowest fuel cost component of their electric rate was Chivac, and they were at about 21 cents a kilowatt hour. And our average fuel cost across all of our systems is about 32 cents a kilowatt hour. That's a very significant difference. Of course, that varies from year to year because you have this complex process by which you calculate that. But those savings stay in the community, and the state of Alaska realizes 50% of those savings because 50% of our kilowatt hour sales are eligible for PCE. So that does come back in the form of reducing our draw on the PCE program.
And small follow-up.
Commissioner Wilson?
Is the 21 cents that you're talking about, is that the total cost, or is that without the fuel surcharge?
That's just the fuel surcharge, yes, because our fuel is captured through a direct rate. So our cost of power adjustment is the full fuel cost in that community. So we have a base rate, which is 30 cents for the first 700 kilowatt hours, 20 cents for anything above that, plus the fuel charge. So for the person, the residential user, they're paying 51 cents in Chivac for the first 700 kilowatt hours, 500 of which are subsidized by PCE. There has been no change in consumption since we injected wind in there, which started 2 years ago. So there isn't any material change. People don't use more because electricity is less expensive.
Thank you.
Representative Thomas.
Thank you. Mayor, what would happen if they retired your debt? What would that do to the PCE cost? Anything?
Representative Thomas, to the Chair, it would do a substantial amount. Right now, we actually had to take out $12 million in additional long-term debt last year because we are investing so much in our communities. That's our cash match that we bring through the Denali Commission and Renewable Energy Fund grants. So our total debt burden right now stands at about $48 million. So the debt service on that runs about $1.5 million a year. And then, of course, it's the principal payback. So if that debt were to vanish overnight, you would see probably about a 6 to 7 cent per kilowatt hour drop in costs.
Which would be better than PCE, actually. Well,
it would be more permanent. You couldn't take it away.
But what would happen if, let's say, we do put a bill together and you start retiring debt and tell you can't incur any more debt for, you know, because for paying off $48 million would be huge. And then, and that, you know, I'm just worried that once they do it, then you start building it back up again. I mean, I'm looking at major maintenance projects with school districts. In my lifetime down here, we wiped it out twice, and it's bigger than ever now.
I can't speak for the schools, but certainly for us, in electric utility, the life of the plant that you have is finite, and so you have to continue to invest and plant. For the most part, though, we have not drawn down long-term debt for many years until our cash match got so high that we had to draw down additional funds. So we were whittling away very nicely at our long-term debt. But in the last couple of years, we reduced our rates by 2 cents a kilowatt hour. That's a reduction in revenue of $1.5 million a year. We no longer had the reserves. We had to borrow money to build capital.
How many representatives in your area that you serve? One, two, three Representative Edgeman, does it represent Jewell or Heron or any of these? How many?
I've never counted, but I'd say that between the House and the Senate, we probably have 9.
So if they just put $2 million a year over the next 3 or 4 years of their capital request, it would help you a lot.
I think that's a wonderful idea.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I certainly support that, don't get me wrong. AVAC communities, and as great a job as MIRA and AVAC has done, and they have done a phenomenal job. That's, we're talking 54 communities out of almost 200 plus communities. So that's, you know, the difference between the, having the PC program provide temporary relief. And Mr. Chairman, I was just looking at the fiscal note. We do have Sarah Fisher Gold here from Alaska Energy Authority, but according to her projections at the authority, this fund that we've talked about, $700 million, should in about 3 or 4 years' time, assuming 7% earning rate, but in a period of 3 to 4 years, should be able to pay for what this bill proposes to do. Mm-hmm. So it's not too far off where this big chunk of money that we've set aside as an endowment would be able to actually provide for more than what the Power Cost Equals Ocean program is today. And when I saw the fiscal note, you know, that's you know, certainly predicated on an earning rate of 7% a year. Some say 5% should be more realistic. 7% is a bit too ambitious. But it did underscore for me the need that for us to, you know, maybe take a harder look at the PC program, see if there wasn't something we could do today to expand the program that would help not only at the present, but also going in the future.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We're going to go to 4:15. You're eating into your time, but it's.
I'll take your advice.
No, just I mean, if you have something pressing, that.
I'll just ask outside of committee. That's
okay.
Fine.
Any was it? Is there any other testimony on the bill? We'll go ahead and close the public testimony, and for with my sage co-chair on how to proceed.
Bring the bill up.
I'll set this aside, and our next bill up is House Bill 255. Let's see what that means. You gonna have all six co-sponsors?
I was hoping just to have a.
It's not a meeting without Max. Yeah, go ahead. Welcome to that part of the table, Lieutenant Guerra.
Thank you. I was hoping to have somebody sit next to me.
Are you lonely? I'll sit from here, but these are co-primes, too, mostly.
Please proceed, Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative West Guerra, District 23. I don't know if Representative Thomas wants to start out.
Go ahead.
Okay. This bill reinstates what many of us thought we had enacted many years ago, which was a ban on the use of video screens. We thought that included texting. The Department of Public Safety has been doing ads saying you can't text while you drive, at least until about a year ago. And then we ran into a problem with some courts saying that the original bill was not intended to include texting, that we should use the word texting if we meant it. And flawed logic, I'll explain that later. But so in some parts of the state, we're not going to get texting convictions. Here's why it's important to reinstate texting into the law. And so we use the law that was on the books before as the framework. We haven't created a new law. We just reinsert texting and typing, and I'll explain that in a moment. But here's why we want to do it. There are a lot of things that distract people while they drive, but you can't define them. How do you define when a mother can turn around and yell at her kids while she's driving? You can't really define that. How do you define when you can eat a sandwich when you're driving? You can't really define that. But you can define texting. If you text in a four-second text message, you've just gone the length of a football field, that you're not paying any attention to the road. There's been a study by NCSL that says if you text while you drive, you raise your risk of a crash or a near collision by about 20 times. One-third of the people out there right now are texting while they drive. Texting, the studies show, at least doubles your reaction time while you're driving. Those are all things that can cause death. And in Alaska, they have caused death. There has been a very recent accident where somebody was killed because the driver was texting. The driver felt terrible. And that's part of this, is it's an education program also to tell people, you think texting is just sort of a social thing. It's a dangerous thing. It's as dangerous as drunk driving. And I say that with at least one study behind me that says it's as dangerous as drunk driving, and that's in your packet. Texting is not recreational while you're driving. It's a danger to people who you might kill. So those are the reasons why we want to put it in the law. We've been very careful to sort of take into account future technology. We don't just say texting like the judge said we should have said. We say typing while you're driving, or viewing a visual display, a message. And we say typing because you could be texting. You could
That's what all the kids say these days, right?
What? you could be typing.
I ask my nieces and nephews about.
I know Popo. I'm working on my slang, Mr. Chair.
Oh, I don't know. I just didn't know whether that was a. I'm not trying to be facetious or anything, but that's hardly any of my nieces or nephews really understood what the word typing meant.
Right.
They don't know what a typewriter is.
Yeah. I still have one.
Representative Dugan probably had his old Smith Corona. Or
I actually did.
A typewriter is something that frustrates the heck out of you because on your last line when you typo, you have to rip the piece of paper out and throw it in the garbage.
But do you think that term typing is going to keep up? That's talking to your legal. I'm dead serious about this.
Seriously, typing is defined in the dictionary. So as long as all of the dictionaries don't change, slang's not going to replace the word typing from the English language. We say type.
On that point.
Sure.
Texting by voice.
No, we're not covering that. Voice communication. We've been very clear to the speaker. There is not consensus in the House on regulating cell phone talking, and so we're not covering that in this bill because it would sink the bill.
This committee.
No, but we understand it would probably sink the bill that there's not the consensus of the House at this point to govern cell phone use, and those hearings should go ahead, and there are bills on those subjects that that need to be addressed. But we're not covering voice use, and. But we say typing because there's a lot, we don't want to be bound by texting. Technology changes. There's Facebook, there's Twitter, and there's going to be technology down the road that people will be using. So we don't use the word texting. There has been some question by a couple of people, why don't we just use the existing distracted driving statute? Because that's not a crime, number one. And number two, if we were to make it a crime, whether you prosecuted somebody under distracted driving, if we made that a crime, or negligent driving, or reckless driving, the jury gets this instruction. It says, basically, do you think what the person was doing was unreasonable or very unreasonable? And when 35% of people are out there texting, those jurors are not going to come back and say, what I do is unreasonable. You're going to lose those cases. But under this law, if it is passed, the jury will be asked, was the person texting while their car was moving? And the answer will be yes. And jurors tend to be very honest people, and they will answer the question properly.
You could have an injury chain on texting, isn't there? Isn't it pretty? Is that the date and time is pretty clear in there?
If Mr. Chair, you're right. If you get into a car accident and the police do their investigation, they should be able to take your cell phone and find out whether you were texting at the time. Or if there are two officers in the car, and one of the officers is the passenger, and they watch somebody next to them texting, they can catch that person, too. You're not going to catch everybody, like most
cars. Do they have to subpoena that, or is that just something a probable cause? They take it just here? Let me see here.
Mr. Svobodnik could probably answer that, but if you get into a car accident where you've injured somebody, then I think they already have the cause to take the evidence from the car at that point.
Yeah, Ms. Carpenter is here. We'll probably get some comments on the record. We'll go past 4:15. Don't worry about that.
So that's why we don't just use the distracted or negligent driving laws, because the juries will not come back with convictions under those laws. We would like to reinstate the law so we can get those ads back on the air that say texting is a crime, to educate people. To
lend their seatbelt money, which would tell us.
Yeah. Where's my buddy Woody?
And I think I've run through that as quickly as I can. I know the committee is short on time. We tried not to have a lot of people testify. The chief of the Anchorage Fire Department has been online since 1:30, but I think he's left and there might be a substitute there.
Why didn't you have the chief of police instead?
We also have a letter from the head of the Association of Chiefs of Police, and they also support the bill. And that's in your packet. I don't know if they're online. They had scheduling problems and didn't think they could get online.
I
made the mistake of telling them the bill would be earlier. But they have letters in the file. And one of the things that they address in their letters is there was a flaw in the old you can't watch a video while you're driving law. And that was that it allowed law enforcement or first responders to look at videos if it was on a screen that was connected to the car. But fire departments and some police departments are using wireless technology now. So they're technically breaking the law right now. We change it so we don't impede the law enforcement function and say it's okay if you use wireless too if you're looking at the picture of the culprit that you're about to try and find or the location of the building that's on fire. You can't text back. They won't be able to text back. But if it's reasonably necessary for a health or criminal matter, they are allowed, if it's necessary, to look at a wireless screen too. So that's what the bill does. We try to be very careful with the language. We work with the Department of Law to make sure the language didn't leave any holes. And we tried to predict future technology, too, so it wasn't just limited to today's technology.
Representative Wilson had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm looking at page 2, lines 7 to 11, when it's talking about basically anything you have in your car that would have a visual display is the way I look at it. So if I have a GPS or an OnStar or something that's connected into, you know, there, but it's visual, so I can look over there and see a map or see whatever. Is that included in this?
No. Under the original law through the chair, Representative Wilson, that was exempted. If you look at starting on line 20, there were a number of exemptions that the original bill included so that you would not be prosecuted, and one of them includes mapping devices.
Okay. Just one other question.
Wilson.
And so also because this is a misdemeanor, and there's basically no passes or whatever. So we're talking about an 18 or 19 year old. If first offense, if they're texting, then we're going to give them a misdemeanor for doing that up to I'm assuming like a $300 fine.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, only if they're texting while their car is moving. That's the real dangerous thing, and that's how the original bill was written. If you're doing this stuff while the car is moving. If it's an 18 or 19-year-old or a 60-year-old or a 100-year-old, if you're texting while your car is moving, you're in danger of killing somebody. So you can make the case that a misdemeanor is light, but you know, we don't want to come up with some crazy level of crime on this. If it's an a misdemeanor, you will probably have to pay a fine. You could get 0 days in jail if you have a completely clean record, or the judge could remove it from your record if you stay clean for the next 2 years. They have this SIS procedure where they're allowed to do that. If you have a clean record, they might do that for you, too.
Follow up.
I'm Sam Wilson.
But I guess also this bill doesn't distinguish someone who may have just, you know, swerved a little bit versus somebody who actually hits somebody because they're texting. It doesn't matter to what level the accident or anything else is still a misdemeanor. Because it's just texting part. Now, there may be other charges that could come, but the charge for texting-wise doesn't matter whether somebody – from what I'm reading, am I wrong?
Through the chair, that's not correct. I don't mean to say that in a bad way. If you're just texting and you don't hurt anybody, it's a Class A misdemeanor, if you're texting while you're moving. If you injure somebody while you're texting if you injure somebody while you're driving, you could be charged with negligent driving, reckless driving. But if you were texting, it moves it up one level of crime. Because texting,
that's under the original law.
That's under the original bill. And the reason for that is texting is very – it's not premeditated, but you're going into your car knowing you're going to do something dangerous. It's not like yelling at your kids when you're driving your car where you don't know that that's going to happen. You know when you go in your car and you plan on texting – and you put that cell phone right next to you so you can text, it's very close to premeditated. So that's one of the reasons, or that's the main reason for saying we're going to move it up one level of crime if you hurt somebody doing something that you know you should not be doing.
I think we'll differ on that, but that's okay.
Representative Fairclough.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Knowingly, I think, is where we're trying to go, that people know when they're texting.
Right.
Representative Garrett, how about taxi cabs? And the reason I was asking about it is I had the occasion early in March to be in Washington, D.C., and in a taxi cab that actually had a screen device that I hadn't seen before that was actually communicating two ways, and there the screen was calling or asking the taxi cab driver to communicate back. I think it was probably to say a location or a zone that they were in, or I don't know. It was only a minute or so where it was happening, or not even a minute, a few seconds were transpiring. But I know there was data presenting itself on an electronic screen. Could you comment on that?
Sure. Madam Chair, when the original sponsors wrote the original bill, and that was Representative Gatto, Representative Rudenberg, they include an exception for dispatch. So if you look at page 3, line 3, you're allowed to use look at a video screen for dispatching and for transport, passenger transport. That's meant to cover trucking companies, taxi companies. You could make the case that we should take that provision out. You'd have a big impact on business, and I think if we knew of a spate of accidents that were caused in that area, that would give us more pause, but we just don't. And we don't believe that they're typing while they're doing that. So they've sort of been given the same exception that we're giving to police and firefighters. We just don't have the evidence that that's a big danger.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Garrett, I can accept that as an answer. I just think technology is moving, and it wasn't quite on the screen, as I recall it. It wasn't quite what I would say is texting, but it was looking for a response that required their finger to touch the screen. So technology is moving, and we're trying to chase it. So I see the benefit of what you're proposing.
Thank you. Thank you also. I watched Alaska State Troopers, and they're driving 90 miles an hour going like this, too. And, you know, I said, whoa, you know. But they're allowed to do it for safety.
So we have been in touch with law enforcement. They do have internal manuals. They're violating their internal policy when they do that. But we don't want to impinge the law enforcement function. And so it's very hard to define when they're allowed to touch that screen. We say if it's wireless, they can look at the screen if it's necessary for a criminal or health matter. But we did want to be careful not to impinge the law enforcement function.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Yes.
Representative Fira, we had a conversation briefly offline about whether it would be illegal at a stop sign. So just to clarify for the record, if you were at a complete stop under the provisions in the bill before us today, that would not be an illegal act to check a text message that you might be receiving from a child or wherever. If you were in anticipation of something, you could pull over, you could be at a stop sign or a stop light, and if the vehicle wasn't moving, you wouldn't be in violation to briefly look at that while you were sitting at a stop.
Right, for the chair, Representative Fairclough, you're correct. We had to make a policy call, and so what we did was we followed the original bill, which was it's only a crime if you're moving. And you don't want to throw innocent people in jail. You can imagine a circumstance where a husband and wife don't know who's going to pick up the kids, and you're at a red light, and it flashes up, and your wife says, I'm picking up the kids, and you're still at a red light. Why would you throw somebody like that in jail? So we've said only if the car is moving. You know, it's not a perfect solution, but it's the best solution to make sure you don't throw innocent people in jail.
Can I put a little my testimony on it since I am a co-crime? Thank you. Kill that PCE bill. No, Representative Garrett, we had plenty of time in Anchorage this year, you know, because we had dry runs on the finance committee going up there. So we talked to Representative Garrett about this, and the reason I cared and got involved is because of the people who got killed while people were driving and texting. Otherwise, you know, I'd be like, honey, Brad, you don't care. But when people started getting killed over something that we thought we were very clear about in, what, 2008, why not come back and reassure the people that, you know, you can be safe when you're driving? I become such a convert that when my phone goes off, now I have this beep, beep, and I see it. You know, I used to just grab the thing and answer it. Now I pull off on the driveway or turn off or, you know, then get on there because I've caught myself before I got into that habit. I'm looking at it, next thing you know, the truck's wobbling down, and I got a big red truck out there, and it can do damage to those little cars. So I've learned not, you know, to slow it, you know, get off the road, or just wait and see who's texting. But that's why I got involved. And I think we had the request to allow officers to text. And I said, no way. You know, and I think I also told the commissioner of public safety that they were amiss for not going after a person who violated that law and should have went forward and prosecuted them. And by not doing it, was actually showing favoritism. So I believe that we all should live on the same law regardless of who we are. And then it even made me feel better when somebody was following that police car here, what, 2 months ago in Anchorage, and they were videoing him, and he was going all over the road like this and about ran two cars off, and he was in there. He said he's eating. Well, even eating, I believe, was illegal. I thought maybe, but anyway, they thought he was texting at the time. So anyway, I got involved with more of a public safety issue. And you know, my hometown, I don't, you know, unless you don't have texting once you get 3 miles out of town and 2 miles the other way. So you really, you know, your cell phone doesn't even work. So anyway, that's where I got involved. I just want to be on the record. And you're doing a good job, too, Les, so Representative Gear on this. So what we would like to do is to move this out here, the longer we sit here. Unless other people have questions, you know. Oh, jeez. Madam Chair, yes, let's adopt the CS.
Mr. Chairman, I move before the committee the CS for House Bill number 255, Judiciary 27-LS1165-T.
Okay. And I had two hands here, or three. Representative, let's go right down the line. So, okay.
I did it right. You know, which I will assume has to be done, but we just keep getting them, and it makes our job a lot harder when we don't really know, because after all, this is the Finance Committee, when we don't really know what it is we're signing on for in terms of the cost of it. And the second is this. This would be a great bill to trailer, as the other members might know. I've got a theory that people shouldn't be talking on cell phones when they're driving. This would be a great bill to trailer something on that onto, but I have spoken with Representative Guerra, and in the interests of not letting the perfect be an enemy of the good, I have decided not to do that, and I'm going to support this piece of legislation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. In response to your fiscal note, I was going to ask the committee to zero it out. This fiscal note was adopted in 2008 previously, and I'm wondering why Public Defender has an indeterminate fiscal note on this, on top of the fact that we passed the previous bill and that fiscal note should have been covered, unless he thinks I'm wrong, which I don't think so, but because I'm sitting here in finance. and I, you know, Representative?
Mr. Chairman, on the fiscal note that is from the Department of Administration, the allocation of the Public Defender's Office, the OMB, Component 1631, dated 1/23/2012, I move to zero the fiscal note from FY13 through FY18.
Hearing no objections, fiscal note is zeroed out. Representative Costello.
Actually, Mr. Chair, my question is for you, and I'm wondering, that sound you hear going off in your car, are you sure it's not your fish finder?
It could be my GPS.
I know how many gadgets you like to own.
Yeah.
But I did want to say that I signed on as a co-sponsor to this legislation, and it's because last year, after coming to Juneau, getting the key to my rental, I open up the door, my cell phone rings. And it was the first phone call I'd received since, you know, coming to Juneau to serve. and it was a constituent who was calling about this legislation, and he said in his job he drives the Dalton Highway, which is, you know, 414 miles, and for his, you know, for his work, and he said that he just felt that his going to work now was more dangerous because people are using texting while they're driving, and he felt that this bill would improve his work conditions. And so because of that, like you, I'm in support of this legislation. So.
Thank you. This time we'll go to public testimony. Do we have anybody online? Do we have anybody in the audience? Bless you, did a fine job. We got nobody with us. So we'll close public testimony, bring the bill back to the committee. Discussion? Mr. Kochar. Oh, okay.
I wanted to take over the gavel so I could offer you to make a motion.
Oh, so I could do that.
Mr. Chairman, we do have more fiscal notes.
You want to, okay, address the fiscal notes.
Mr. Chairman, we've amended the OMB component number 1631 to a zero, so we've covered that one. From the Department of Law, from the allocation line criminal justice litigation, OMB component number 2202, dated 4-3-2012, FY13 to FY18-0. Next fiscal note from the Alaska court system, allocation line is unidentified. It says the appropriation is to the trial courts. OMB component number 768, dated 1-20-2012, FY13 to FY18-0, fiscal note. The next fiscal note is from the Department of Corrections. The allocation line is to the Commissioner's Office. The OMB component number is 694, dated 1-20-2012, FY13 to FY18-0, fiscal note. The last fiscal note in the packet today is from the Department of Administration. The allocation to the Office of Public Advocacy, OMB component number 43, dated 1-20-2012, FY13 to FY18-0, fiscal note.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
No other questions on the fiscal note.
Representative Thomas. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I move from committee CS for House Bill number 255, Judiciary Version 27-LS1165-T, with accompanying fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, the bill is moved from committee. Let's see. We will next convene. Tomorrow morning there will be a meeting of the subcommittee, which has been characterized as doing nothing and sabotaging. I appreciate the work that that committee is working. If asking questions is being dilatory, then be dilatory. I've been offended by some of the press coverage on Representative Costello's efforts on the film tax credit bill. So keep at your work, and we hope to bring that bill up soon. And shame on the people who are mischaracterizing the work of the subcommittee. And after that, we'll convene at 9:30 a.m. to take up the bill previously scheduled, House Bill 360, as well as any lingering issues that we're able to call together. With that, we are adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow.
Thank you.